Hello and welcome.
Hi, I'm Atrey.
And I'm Pavan.
And this is the Big Book Project.
Big books demand heavy work, and we're up for it. In this podcast, we take on some of our favorite, often obscure and unpopular books, and unpack the ways in which they have made sense to us.
Today's book is In Theory by Ajaz Ehmed.
All right, Atrey, so let's just get straight into it, shall we?
Sure.
I know that when we talked about doing this podcast, we said we're going to pick up some books that we want to read, some books that may not have anything to do with our professional work. And we gave each other fair warning that these might be difficult books. And you had the first shot and you go right ahead and pick up Ajaz Ehmed's In Theory. Probably one of the most difficult books that I've ever had to read. Why? When did you first come to know of this book?
Right, thanks. Ajaz Ehmed's In Theory has been a subject of conversation in fireside chats in our house for a long time. My husband is a Marxist literary theorist, and him and his colleagues are very, very fond of this book, especially in its critiques of certain forms of dominant Western Marxism and its literary critiques. And those have been the context in which I first came across Ajaz Ehmed's name and the name of this book. Several of these essays were written in the 80s and the 90s and were republished as a collection of essays as this book In Theory. And I remain curious about it, even though I hadn't had a chance to read it up until now. And Ajaz Ehmed passed away recently, about a month ago, and people started talking about this book again. And then I thought that what better chance than to inaugurate our podcast with Ajaz Ehmed's quite provocative, quite controversial book.
Sure. So, well, I guess that's one aspect of it, right? Which is the fact that this book is being talked about so much, it's been in the news, and sure, it might just help the podcast if we began with that book. But what drew you to the book? You've mentioned Ajaz Ehmed and how you came to know about the book, but surely there must have been something else that motivated you to actually pick it up and read it. So why did you decide to read it?
So very early on, in the 90s, Ajaz Ehmed is predicting the proliferation of identity politics and its kind of easy political cachet that has come to dominate the intellectual domains of the academia and the publishing industry in the global north and in countries like India. He's writing in the 90s, but he's predicting something that is happening now. And that is a very, very much a buzzword of woke politics and people appropriating each other's kind of signatures of suffering and victimhood and getting opportunities in the intelligentsia, in the academia, through those networks and that kind of discourse. And he pits a battlefield between Marxism and identity politics. And that is very attractive to me. I think I'm very much on Ajaz Ehmed's political side, even though I have some bits where I nitpick with him. But by and large, I'm on his side by the time I ended reading the book, that Marxism is not identity politics, although it is often conflated with identity politics in today's world. And that is the reason I was drawn to this book. I knew from before that he had a very, very trenchant critique of a dominant form of popular identity politics.
So I hear you when you say that you're very much on Ajaz Ehmed's side. By the time you finish reading this book, it would be difficult, I suppose, for anyone not to be on his side, the way that he sort of forcefully charges through and in some cases utterly demolishes people that he does not like. But speaking of which, Ajaz Ehmed throughout, and particularly in the opening chapters of the book, makes it very clear that he absolutely rejects what he calls theory as conversation. And he's waving the flag saying that there must be partisanship in the politics of theory. As someone who's taught widely and who's taught in the liberal academy, how do you think about that? How do you think about his advocacy of such partisanship in the politics of theory? And what sort of impact may that have on the academy in what we now recognize as an increasingly radicalized India.
Thanks. In Ejaz Ahmed's political universe, theory and action are inextricably linked. He cannot stand, he's extremely contemptuous, as you rightly pointed out, of theory as vanity, theory as social capital, theory as the business of opportunism, that people who can speak theory move through a certain infrastructure of opportunity in the social and political domain of the academia, of certain kinds of publishing opportunities and so on and so forth. He reads, he watches in the 80s, in the 90s, while he's writing, post-colonial theory, post-structuralist theory, becoming a certain form of elite social capital. And he rejects this stance strongly by pointing out that theory emerges from certain kinds of political stances. If you divorce theory from political stances that it emerges from, you're devaluing theory itself. There's no point reading some big fat books if you're not going to believe in or reject, as you stand in your own life, the ideas, the politically charged ideas, the controversial, provocative ideas that these books emerge out of. And as I teach, I definitely take that stance. In today's world, if you're neutral, you're just siding with some side or the other. If you say that you're neutral, usually the conservative side or the status quo, you're siding with the status quo and couching it as neutrality. There's nothing called theoretical or political neutrality in today's world. In my classes, as a teacher of theory, which is, I think, one of the most difficult things to teach, without getting students to become fashionable in, you know, spouting Foucault or Derrida or whatever, something like that. I try to strike a connection between the self and the text and the world. These three things are to be invoked in simultaneity. I want students to revere the text. Sure, the text is really important, but not in excess of revering the world in all its strangeness and simplicity simultaneously. And I think Ejaz Ahmed would have been on my side if he were alive today and he was part of this conversation, that theory doesn't exist as divorced from the world. It is very much part of the world, and you have to very much engage with the world while engaging with theory if you want to do justice to the big word theory with a big T at all.
Indeed, and I think given that a few moments ago you said that you were on his political side, I think it's only reasonable to assume that he would back you up as well. But speaking of these big fat books, as you describe them, and how they're sort of mired in this political context from which you cannot separate them, one big fat book that I've managed to finish reading fairly recently and which I've heard you mention is Tomb of Sand. Now, that's, of course, another book that's in the news. It got the International Booker and whatnot. And shortly after it won that prize, you know, that great chronicler of Indian events, Amul, decides to make an advertisement about it. People make a huge brouhaha about how a certain politician has still not congratulated the winner and so on and so forth. But I hear you when you say that this then becomes some part of what we could loosely describe as post-colonial canon, or how it might now be seen as the representative of India and more broadly the third world in the West. Now, this is a term, third world literature, that Ejaz Ahmed seems to have disdain for only in marginally short measure than he does for Edward Said or Salman Rushdie. Now, why? I mean, what does he say third world literature is, and why is he so uncomfortable with this usage? What are his arguments with that term?
Right. So I think Ejaz Ahmed would have revised some of his comments had he been alive today, when Gitanjali Sri and Peruman Murugan and Manoranjan Bapari and Shamsurrahman Farooqi are all translated in English and are widely read in the Anglophone post-colonial public sphere. On the third world, remember that he's writing at the time of the rise of Rushdie. Rushdie has not got the Booker yet. when he's writing. But he's fast rising up the canon sphere of post-colonial literature, and something called Indian Anglophone literature is being manufactured through the signature of Rushdie. Roy has not even written God of Small Things at this time when Ejaz Ahmed is writing these essays. The non-aligned world is the geopolitical space that emerges after the Second World War, after the impact, the dreadful impact of the two world wars in the 20th century, and witnesses decolonization as an event across Asia, Latin America, and Africa. That is what we understand through the major event of the Bandung Conference in 1957, and so on and so forth, as the Third World. But Ahmed is talking about the emergence of Third World literature, where he accuses Frederick Jameson, a very well-known Western American Marxist literary scholar, of deploying a certain national allegory, a technique of national allegorizing of Third World literature. Now, what does he mean by this? Ahmed means to critically treat this category Third World, saying it may be a geopolitical space. It is a vast space of innumerable difference and unspeakable amount of complexity with which people engage their decolonized and post-World War II, post-Bretton Woods institutions world, that is the latter half of the 20th century, where we see the rise of the Cold War and most new nation states, young nation states are pulled in this way or this or that direction by the Cold War and so on and so forth. A certain aesthetic arises out of that condition, which cannot be reduced to the decolonization movement of that particular nation state only. The two things that Ejaz Ahmed is saying in criticism of Frederick Jameson here. One is that it cannot be reduced to the nationalist movement of that nation state, because the nationalist movement is often carried out by a certain kind of internal bourgeois movement. Internal bourgeois groups and their factions who articulate a certain kind of nationalistic imagination, which is essentially a bourgeois ideal. And Ejaz Ahmed reminds us time and again throughout this book, not only in the Frederick Jameson chapter, but also in the Said chapter, also in the Rushdie chapter, that do not mistake Indian, whatever is called in the global public sphere as Indian literature, to be inclusive of, say, a Dalit woman in Chhattisgarh living in a completely different set of circumstances than what Rushdie can imagine when he writes Midnight's Children. Midnight's Children may well be representative of an Indian horizon, an Indian aspiration, an Indian aesthetic, but can you really unpack the entire complexity of India as a nation state by calling Rushdie the emerging Indian writer? Rushdie is ultimately someone who's an emigre. He lives most of his life in Britain and tries living in Pakistan for a while, and so on and so forth. The second thing Ejaz Ahmed tries to say is that across the Third World, there is immense amount of difference and complexity. By categorizing that entire global political formation of the Third World as one aesthetic box, one literary aesthetic box, you cannot make any sense of it. You cannot understand Marquez by comparing him to Mahashweta Devi, to a writing of maybe comparable things, but out of completely different historically specific situations. And their contexts are to be understood if we have to do justice to their literary endeavors. Ultimately, I want to say that that this national allegory technique that Jameson deploys and Ejaz Ahmed critiques is very much a Western tendency to see the stories or the literary work that comes out of the Third World as symbolic of the Third World condition and nothing beyond that. Ahmed is saying repeatedly that you must understand the literary work, the result of the authorial adventure, as something that is representative of the social realities and the historical realities of the origin, place of origin of that work. But not only that, it's something beyond. Marquez cannot only be reduced to the dictatorial regime of Pinochet, anybody else cannot be reduced to the caste system or the religious bigotry out of which those stories arose. The stories speak for something beyond the what he calls the tale of the tribe.
And the tribe, as you mentioned, is sadly ascribed some sort of characteristics or given some sort of identity based on a conflation of dramatically different situations and contexts. And what I suppose makes it worse for Ejaz Ahmed is that this is done through the works of authors who are not indeed refugees, who can't even claim that position, but are in fact immigrants and in fact fairly privileged immigrants. But you did also mention that giving it this sort of nationalist allegory is something that he has a huge problem with. And he goes on to mention how the nationalist movement is essentially the reflection of some sort of bourgeois ideal in many of these nations. Now, may I just say that you're not going to hear those terms from anybody other than a Marxist. And Ejaz Ahmed, of course, stridently declares his love for, his commitment to Marxism all throughout the book, and indeed in his life, in his work, in his talks, and so on and so forth. But I'd like to hear from you how you would describe his commitment to Marxism, and why are we still talking about it? You said, for example, that these essays were written back in the day, in the 80s, in the 90s. How is it still relevant to politics in the contemporary world and in India today?
So let me take that on two parallel tracks. One, you're asking me what is Ejaz Ahmed's commitment to Marxism and how would I describe it? And two, what is the relevance of Marxism in the current world, or at least Ahmed's Marxism in the current world, if I understand you correctly. Ahmed's Marxism, one must remember, is ultimately he's a literary theorist. He's very much understood, you know, like the popular understanding of Marxism is that Marxism is this vulgar economism, that it reduces everything to whether people possess goods and services and land and capital or not, the haves and the have-nots. Marxism doesn't end there. And 20th century Marxism that arises in various parts of Europe alongside the various post-colonial Marxism that arise in Asia, Africa, and especially Latin America, are very aware that a certain kind of ideological and aesthetic, and I say those two things together, ideological and aesthetic projects arise out of a commitment to Marxism, or the Marxist lens for a certain aesthetic project. What is this aesthetic project? It is a project of looking at how certain kinds of material dispossessions, certain kinds of material divides, the material world, and to use a very weird Marxist term, historically specific materialism, historical materialism, it becomes the lens to see what kinds of ideas, what kinds of dreams and nightmares, what kinds of aesthetics, what kinds of art, what kinds of poetry, what kinds of stories arise from a society based on its long history of dispossession. And so dispossession is not a story that ends with itself. It leads on to a whole ideative world, a world of, like I said, dreams and nightmares that lead one to inquire constantly, be haunted by the shadow of unfair exploitation, dispossession, in the narrative world, in the aesthetic world, and in the ideological world. So Marxisms generally make a difference. I'm sorry, I'm going to get a little bit academic here, between base and superstructure. Base meaning the material substratum of society, the land, the factories, the whatever, the money and whatever, and superstructure, meaning the ideative universe, the art, the ideas, the television shows, the movies, the religious ideas, etc. And the two are connected. Ahmed is of the Marxism that would believe that the superstructure is not only influenced by the base, it influences the base back. So it's a certain qualification of Marxism in that sense, traditional Marxism in that sense. And Ahmed is definitely of the opinion that you can detect, diagnose certain forms of endemic economic exploitations, oppressions, long-term historical marginalizations by understanding literature through a Marxist lens. This is the Marxist literary project. And Jameson and others are very much on board. But their Marxism is race blind, it is politically kind of uncomfortable with giving post-colonial peoples across the world who have various kind of artistic and literary works available in their own languages and in English or in French or what or the European languages of their erstwhile colonizers. In through these works, they are yielding a certain Marxist sensibility. And Ahmed's discomfort is that he finds himself a guest on that table. He's very much an owner of that table. If at all there was a Marxist table, a high table, if you will, to use the Oxonian analogy, but Ahmed finds himself as a person from the South Asian origin, Pakistani origin, as a committed Marxist, constantly being given guesthood on the table. And he wants to unlearn this guestism. And ultimately in that Frederick Jameson chapter, he ends by saying, if I am to be treated, my work is to be treated entirely as a South Asian scholar, then Jameson should be treated entirely as someone who's a Western scholar or an American scholar. And you know, why do the selective reduction? He's very critical of the Western Marxist, certain blind spots of Western Marxism, whereby Jameson and his people, scholars who are loyal to that tradition, give a certain kind of, magnanimous recognition to an amorphous entity called the third world itself, without understanding or trying to give recognition to its specificity, its historical context, and its original Marxist claims. Lastly, I will say that Marxism in the current world, even after 89, after the communist kind of big political project has ended and communist parties in India and elsewhere are increasingly dying or, have shut shop, Marxism remains alive in the social sphere. There's something called the New Left, which is a term that became popular in the 70s and the 80s with Raymond Williams and others, who saw the left surviving even after the end of the Cold War, the left surviving in films, in literature, in social protest movements, in social movements, in certain kinds of, the anti-WTO, the anti-war, the anti-Vietnam War protests, and so on and so forth. So, and lastly, I want to say that Marxism is alive, Ahmed's Marxism is alive very much in the claim. However faint you might say, however faint or dying that claim is, the claim is still present, of trying to imagine the world outside the national incarceration, outside of nationalism and the method of nationalism, which has so incarcerated our political imagination that we cannot imagine a world where it doesn't matter whether you're Indian or you're West Indian or you're German, your ideas and your particular contribution to an intellectual project is not judged by, especially if you're coming from the non-West, not judged by your third world origin.
Right. And I found myself grinning about halfway through your answer, because only from an academic will you hear an apology for getting somewhat academic. And I dare say that at about 5 seconds in, most people would have said, oh my God, this is really academic. So leave it to an academic not to realize when they started being academic, but you're a fantastic academic. So thank you for that. And this is very instructive indeed. Particularly instructive, I thought, was how you describe what Ejaz Ahmed says about materialism and how materialism sort of becomes this landing stage almost, from which you then venture into, you said, hopes and dreams and nightmares, into the world of the aspirational mind. And you also used the vocabulary of detect and diagnose, and just putting all of these things together, it just brings to mind Ejaz Ahmed's outright condemnation of what he calls the psychologizing impulse that he says plagues Said's descriptions of Orientalism. He talks about how Said thinks of Europe or the West as this monolithic entity, how Said tries to decipher its mind, and he says there have historically been processes witnessed elsewhere in the Islamicate and Brahmanism, for example, of identifying an other and casting them as dangerous and inferior. So he says this is something that plagues Said's work, and this is something that should be outright avoided. And yet he begins the charge in the book almost by saying things like, so fundamental and even genetic is the Indian university's relationship with, or indeed dependence upon, its British and American counterparts, that knowledges produced there become immediately effect here, in a relation of imperial dominance shaping even the way that we think of ourselves. Now, how do we square these two things? On the one hand, he says, don't do it, don't try and imagine what the mind of an imagined entity, which is indeed diverse, but your imagining it to be one solid, consistent kind of mind. And yet he assumes that the Indian university, Indian academics are all exactly the same, and how they're all equally influenced by the same shape of ideas. So how do we put these two parts together?
Right. Thanks. Let me take the first part that's easier, the Said and the West question. I'm remembering Tagore's caution about this in his 1924 Japan lectures, where Tagore is saying that the West is not an evil thing unto itself. In its imperial ambition, in its corruption, the West as an ideological and as an intellectual project has become profane. But there's nothing particularly evil about the West in itself, Europe per se. Said seems to have one, a presentist analysis. He's talking about the 70s and the 80s and the rise of Israeli nationalism and his critics of Israeli politics, Israeli-American combination in global politics. This is where Said's political opposition to the West kind of creeps into his theoretical and literary condemnation of the West. And this is what Ejaz Ahmed, I think, is very correct in pointing out, that you cannot possibly see a consistency between Homer and Dante and Conrad. You can particularly nitpick with each of them and find fault with each of them, but you have to do so in their historical context. On the question of the other, which is related, and Tagore is saying that, it's very possible that if we were in an imperial seat, we would behave exactly similarly. And today we see post-colonial countries which are, capable of muscle flexing, including India, do so exactly, do the exact same things as their erstwhile colonizers did to their marginal populations, including religious minorities. On the question of the other, I'm reading this fantastic book by Richard Kearney called Strangers, Monsters and Gods, which is where he's showing that the other emerges as an innate fear of components of the self, which you hate. And you derive a sacrificial other and you persecute him in order to exorcise those hateful things about yourself. You attribute the other with these hateful qualities which you hate within yourself. And that is where the self-other kind of difficult and sometimes romanticized, fetishized and forever fraught with controversy kind of relationship, dyadic relationship, emerges. And Ajaz Ahmed is very clear-eyed about this, that that just othering the West back is not going to help our political emancipation or our aesthetic emancipation in any way. And I very much support his critiques of Said in that sense. And I was reminded of Tagore as I read it. On what he does to India, then that's the more murky question. He's writing at a time, especially given his exposure to post-colonial Anglophone literary theory, that circle, especially as it is kind of rising to extreme fame and sexiness in the 80s and the 90s. You know, POCO is the thing to do, and a large number of scholars of post-colonial origin are using this social capital of difference, saying, I know something that originates in my own biography, which I will then sell as intellectual capital in a Western university or in any kind of elite scenario, in the publishing scenario included. Ahmed is very quick to catch on that form of opportunism, that form of easy translation of biographical privilege into intellectual capital. Where he falters is that he doesn't give the Indic or the South Asian aesthetic tradition enough autonomy unto itself to point out that South Asia has aesthetic theory from the Persianate and the Indic traditions as far back as the 4th century BC. I might be getting the date wrong of texts like the Abhinavaguptas Natyashastra, and that's the first thing that comes to my mind of a treatise on aesthetic theory. But the Anglophone circles are not interested or concerned about this corpus. And so Ajaz Ahmed's exposure purely to the Anglophone POCO intellectual discourse is making him falter and creating a blind spot in his own view of Indian literary discourse, of which there's a wide variety available, and he seems to be blind to those complexities. And lastly, he probably doesn't take into account all of those other textual traditions, especially aesthetic traditions, because they get classified as religious texts. I remember Patrick Oliver in his introduction to the Upanishads said this, that Western philologists, especially German philologists, looked at the Upanishads and they knew they had a category called religion and a theology, more importantly, in which most of this stuff would fit. But the Upanishads are in many ways aesthetic theory, in many ways social theory, in many ways philosophy, in many ways astronomy, a large number of things. You can't exactly classify them together in a category called theology or religion. They are that and many many other things simultaneously. And in this, I will say, Ahmed is a child of the West, very much in his tendency to ignore Indic and Islamic traditions emerging and Buddhist traditions emerging from South Asia, which have much to say about these questions of aesthetics and literary production, to which he probably sidelines them because he considers them to be religious, and a Marxist irritation with religion is probably resurging here. Lastly, I would like to say Ahmed will probably revise his conclusions about the Indian literary public sphere had he been alive today, where Gitanjali Shree has recently won the International Booker with her translator Daisy Rockwell, and several others like Manoranjan Vyapari, Flamshun Rahman Faruqi, and I was thinking of Perumal Murugan, among others, who are now widely read in the Anglophone public sphere. This is inaugurating a certain kind of literary supermarket, to evoke Ahmed's term, in which a taste of other languages is available to the New York Times reading liberal who wants to kind of read beyond the Anglophone literary world. But there are some laudable efforts in this sphere. I'm thinking of the Jadavpur University Press, which kind of has evaded the Anglophone port of call by getting translations of Murakami done directly from Japanese to Bangla, and various translations of Sartre, etc., from French to Bangla, and not through English. So Ahmed's prediction that Marquez would come to Delhi via London, including the example of Jadavpur University Press, are sometimes not true. So Ahmed is true for some occasions and contexts, but we can't take Ahmed's prediction about the Indian literary public sphere to be entirely correct in its predictive capacity.
I'd agree. I mean, we are, of course, positioning or situating these questions in 2022, and we must be reminded once again that Ahmed is speaking in the 80s, in the 90s. But nonetheless, I agree that it's surprising. I mean, it isn't just a blind spot, it's a surprising blind spot. I mean, just recall the conversations he has in the book about Dante's Inferno. And he flattens you with his knowledge of Islamic theory, of facets of that religion. And he brings so many of those arguments to play when he talks in the book about that text and about how other authors have seen it. And so it's surprising that this happens. Thank you very much, Atre.
Thank you.
I think all those hours and hours that I spent reading In Theory, pleasurable as they were, have probably only now sort of come to make a lot more sense in my head. And that's in large measure because of your responses. This has been great fun.
Thank you so much. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Have a good night, everyone.
Good night, everyone, and we'll be back soon with our second episode, another big book. Bye-bye.
Stay tuned.